Yeah, today I thought we discuss the phase space of Maxwell theory. So last time we talked about when in space-time dimension 2, we found the phase space. Coordinates, say, P and Q. Q is equivalent to Q plus 1. And Hamiltonian. So in fact, what we found is that the system is equivalent to is equal to a one-dimensional particle moving on a circle. So of course, in dimensions bigger than 2, it's a lot more complicated. So I'm going to work on some manifold M. M is space. And for simplicity, maybe I'll take M just to be flat with metric just delta ij, just to keep the notation simple. So the phase space, as always, is the space of solutions to the equations of motion mod gauge. So we first, of course, we need to write down the equations of motion, which are the Maxwell equations. So the field A, which is has AI space components and AT, so the Lagrangian is Fij, Fij plus Ftj, Ftj, looks like this. Where F is the field strength. And the equations of motion are equals 0. Okay, so this should be all familiar from what you guys have done before. So these equations just come from varying the local regime. So if you remember from our discussion before of simpler gauge theories, the time component of the gauge field plays a special role. And what we did was we could always choose a gauge for which the time component vanishes. So we're going to do that here. So we choose a gauge. AT is equal to 0. This is possible as the gauge variation of AT is the time derivative of my gauge parameter. So this choice absorbs the T dependence of chi, and we're left with chi, which is independent of t. So note, it's important to note that we still impose the equation, which comes from varying t. So this is the equation that we saw before give us the symplectic reduction. And this gauge, the gauge where I said one of the components of the gauge field is zero, it's called the axial gauge. It's actually kind of a bad thing to do to choose the axial gauge. It tends to be too singular to really work with when you want to build a quantum field theory. But it is the choice which leads you to familiar formulas from canonical quantization. So that's why we're using it. Okay, so the remaining equations so this one is going to be the one moment map equation, so this is going to be to do with gauge variation. So this first equation is what's going to be important. So this equation is we written as del I Fij plus del t of del t Aj minus del j At equals 0. But sorry, this should be a minus sign. Minus because we're working in Lorentzian signature. Sorry. However, we're using the gauge where AT vanishes. So we find in this gauge, this term drops out, and we find the second derivative of aj is equal to tau I fij. Which is surely just a familiar form of Maxwell's equations, if you think about it. But, so the nice thing about this equation is that it really lends itself to thinking about the phase space analysis, because it just looks like, so we've gauge fixed by setting at to 0, and now we've just got a nice second order equation in time. So we find that the phase space before symplectic reduction should have coordinates given by aj and its first derivative. Aj of x, I'm going to call this qj, and the conjugate momentum. So the equations of motion express everything in terms of these. The higher derivatives will be expressed by the equation in terms of these p's and q's. Okay, so any questions about how we've derived this? Okay, now, it may appear obvious that P and Q are canonically conjugate just from the form of the action. But personally, I never find that super satisfying, and I always preferred to study the two-point function. If you remember, the way we derived the canonical commutation relations for just free particle in one dimension was I studied the two-point function and I found a singularity when we moved one past the other. So we can do the same thing here in gauge theory. So we're going to use the propagator and this is time space. I'm going to put some operator there, which measures, say, a of x maybe x0, xt, and then I want to send t to 0, and we'll find something like delta x equals x prime delta. We'll find a term like this so that there's some kind of singularity when t goes to 0 and these points are coincident. Now, a full treatment of the propagator, like you might find in a textbook, is a little complicated because to really quantize Young-Mills theory properly, you need to introduce ghosts and so on. But there is a trick which we used before, which allows us to just write down the propagator, at least the propagator connecting two operators like that. What we need to do, so the propagator is equal to the field sourced by this operator in our chosen gauge. So in other words, we just have to solve the equations in motion with the source term. So the equations of motion, as written down up there in this gauge, are del t squared k minus del I f I k is equal to delta k j. Delta x equals x naught, delta t equals naught. So I'm putting a source term on the right-hand side for this equation. So you get this, you know, this equation with the source term is what you get by adding this operator to the action and varying my fields, pick up this delta function term. Okay. Now, here's how we're going to see the axial gauge is, in fact, not a good idea in general. Although useful for this particular calculation. So a first approximation to a solution is simply to set AK to be a delta function. It's not delta function t is greater than or equal to 0 times t times delta ki. So this is, of course, the propagator we would use for a free scalar. And we plug it into this expression. The first term will do the correct thing. I'm going to differentiate twice with respect to t and pick up a delta function. But the second term will just be some kind of spatial derivative. And we'll only hit the delta function on space. So if we do this, we get so if I do like delta t squared with this A is equal to the thing I want, plus minus terms from here. Let's go change. these terms. Are like t delta t going to 0, some derivatives applied to the delta function on space. Okay. So what that tells us is we can solve the whole thing by adding on higher order terms in t. And so the full solution looks just like this, but it's a series in t where each term of the series is accompanied by some derivatives hitting there. Equals x naught plus t cubed over 6 Laplacian on space plus so as an aside this is a slightly nasty expression because if t was big, then I'd have a very long series with lots of derivatives applied to a delta function, and it's more and more non-local. But if t is really small, it's actually fine. Okay, now, so we conclude that the two-point function a k, ai x equals x naught, t equals 0 times the derivative in k, derivative in time, is equal to, it's what you get by taking this series and differentiating it with respect to t. So it's a delta function t greater than equal 0, delta function x equals x naught. That's this term, delta ij, plus terms that tend to 0. As t goes to 0. So this is the only term that's going to matter, because it's going to give us a discontinuity, the two-point function, which is the Poisson bracket. Okay. Maybe I've gone through this in too much detail, but yeah.
Wait, isn't AI itself also proportional to t, and we are evaluating at t equals 0?
Say that again, sorry?
So we are evaluating AI at t equals 0?
Yes.
But isn't it 0 then?
So this expression here is the field sourced by this operator. So I insert this operator,
okay,
and it sources some field, and then I measure that field with the other operator. And because this has a t derivative, see, that cancels. So now we've taken the Lagrangian for Maxwell theory and figured out at least something about the phase space. We have p and q coordinates, which are canonically conjugate. But we have to do a couple more things before we figure out the full answer. We have to figure out the Hamiltonian, and we have to perform some symplectic reduction. So firstly, what is the Hamiltonian? Well, we have qi is ai, pi is the time derivative of ai, and the equations of motion say, well, of course, pi is the time derivative of qi. That's the obvious one. This is the one you always have. But the time derivative of pi, which is the second derivative of ai, well, that's equal to difij. For fij is del I qj minus del j qi. And we have these canonical commutation relations, pi qj x x prime is delta ij delta x equals x prime. Okay, so we have to build a Hamiltonian that is the thing whose Poisson bracket generates this time evolution. So h must satisfy h of qi is equal to pi, and h of pi of x is equal to I get my messed up my indices there. Del j f j I see. There's a possibility I made a sign error. So we can solve for h just by using these equations, right? So h must have a p squared term, because the p squared will turn q into p. And it must have something involving q squared, something two q's, because you want to turn a p into a q. So the solution turns out to be h is equal to some I integral over x p I x squared plus f I j. Let's make this an implicit fij x squared. And I think there's a factor of 4 here. So first term is obvious. For the second term, we need to know that fij x squared pk is something like this. Sorry, no, let me say this like this. I want to integrate over x, because there's going to be some integration by parts.
Is there no delta function for the indices?
Here there's a sum over the ij indices.
Oh, right, sorry.
Because it's square, so they're contracted. Okay, this is like very simple. So let's maybe just quickly go through this exercise. So we want to look at integral over x, also in bracket, pk, so del I qj minus del j qi pk squared. Where is the eraser? Integral over x twice del I p j minus j q I x times del I delta x equals x prime delta j equals k. Sorry, this is slightly tedious. So this is just plugging in the canonical commutation relations, and in fact, I think I dropped a sign because the q and p have the opposite canonical commutation relations. And now we just integrate this by parts, move this over here. We're going to get something, this del, this derivative will become a derivative of the field strength. And the other thing will also become a derivative of the field strength, because the field strength is anti-symmetric, and these come with opposite signs. We get just the derivative of the field strength times 2. Something like 4. Something like that. Okay, so that's very elementary manipulation. Great, so if we've got everything correct, this is the Hamiltonian for Maxwell theory in any dimension. It's the usual Hamiltonian, p squared, plus the size of the field strength. I mean, kind of as one would expect. The final thing we need to understand is symplectic reduction So as always, AT couples to some mu, and symplectic reduction we set mu equals 0, and then look at orbits of the flow. So the thing that couples to AT, well, it's something they realize is a kind of Gauss law. It's just del I pi. So in the original Lagrangian, we have this term, FIT is AT del I PI plus AT times terms involving AT. So we're going to ignore the terms which have AT twice because we're using the gauge without zero. We're only looking at the equation coming from varying AT in that gauge. So this piece here is the moment map constraint. So in the physical phase space, we have the constraint del I pi of x is equal to 0, and Qj is equivalent to del j chi, and this comes if I look at the Poisson bracket between some average of this moment map constraint and Q, J, you pick up by integration by parts del J chi. So the flow for this moment map is adding on this del J chi. Let's see. Okay, any questions about how we've done this analysis? Or okay, so I realize we've done this kind of pretty thorough treatment of, like, you start with a Lagrangian and you study the equations of motion, you build a phase space from which you can build canonical commutation relations, and by geometric quantization the Hilbert space, you can see something about the spectrum of states. I am a little unsure what would be the most useful thing to do for the remainder of the course, actually, because I've been very busy this quarter and haven't prepared this course as carefully as I should have. So I'd like to get your guys' opinions.
Can we do chain assignments?
Yeah, we can absolutely do transignments. Yeah, that was one direction I was thinking about. This is a fun example because the phase space is finite dimensional, and you really need to use, it's not like it's not just like this with P and Q coordinates. It's a more complicated phase space. How does everybody else feel? I mean, that was one direction I was thinking. I mean, I don't know. Mean, another possible direction would be to look at a little more into the mathematics of gauge fields, understanding the field strength as a relationship to the Chern classes and so on. Or another direction, also related to Chern-Simons theory, would be to think about Weissmann terms and other similar topological terms. But are there any, anybody else have any thoughts?
What is the last direction you said?
Well, I suppose it's something that wouldn't really fill the whole thing, but I thought it might be interesting to look a little bit at Weissmann terms and signal models. These, well, something, we've seen that the symplectic manifolds, in order to build a good quantum theory, they have to have some kind of, the size of the symplectic form has to be quantized. It has to be the field strength of a U1 gauge field. So there's closely related quantization phenomenon present in Chern-Simons theory, where the coefficient of the action has to be an integer for a very similar reason. And also in a signal model, there's a term you can add to the Lagrangian whose coefficient has to be quantized, again, for a very similar reason. So perhaps we can look at that, both Chern-Simons theory and the Weissmann model. Yeah, that seems like a good direction. So maybe I'll start by saying a little bit about the Chern-Simons Lagrangian. Suppose I have M. Manifold of dimension 3. A is a gauge field of M. For U1, or for UN if you prefer. So the usual Yang-Mills Lagrangian is integral f i j a f i j a. But in dimension 3, there is another term you can add. Which is a bit strange. So, the Yang-Mills Lagrangian is the integral of some density, This density itself is a gauge invariant quantity. If I apply a gauge transformation, this quantity does not change. But this other term you can add, it's the integral of something which is not a gauge invariant density, but whose gauge variation is a total derivative. So there's a couple of ways to say what this other term is. Here's the slick way to say what the other term is. Richard Simon's term. This is a way which will tell you why it's quantized, why its coefficient is not arbitrary, but it's not very helpful for perturbation theory. The slick way is you choose some four-dimensional manifold with boundary M, now you extend the gauge field A to this four manifold. And what to write down the Chern-Simons term, we're going to use the fact that in dimension four, there is two possible things you can write down. On this four manifold, there are two dimensionless Lagrangians we can build. There's the usual Fij, Fij. This is the usual Yang-Mills term. But there's the other term, which is what's going to be important here. There's another term where I contract these indices with the epsilon tensor. So this term is often written as integral f wedge f, where wedge here means use epsilon. So this term is one of the terms in the QCD Lagrangian. This is called the theta angle. It's kind of a famous thing because it appears that this is non-zero but very small, and there's no explanation for this. So the trick is, if my three manifold is the boundary of a four manifold, then integral n four k f wedge f, for k an integer, this describes a Lagrangian for the 3D theory. Why is this? So I'll just maybe go through this quickly, and next time go to the other more concrete formula for the Chern-Simons Lagrangian. one reason you can tell why this has to be true is if you've studied QCD at all, you know that the theta angle is periodic. So if the theta angle is an integer, in fact, it's the same as the theta angle being zero. So if it's an integer, we only get a boundary term. But a more mathematical reason why this is true if n prime is some other four manifold, which also has boundary as m, then I can glue has no boundary. And it's a math fact. Sorry, there should be some factors of 2 pi I. I'm missing one over 4 pi squared, that expression. Integral over a closed four manifold is an integer. So why is this good? So like this term, this f wedge f term, is insensitive to the details of the gauge field. It only depends on the global topology of the gauge field. What it does is it's called the instanton number. It just like measures how many instantons you have. So why is it useful that it's an integer? Well, the point is, in the path integral, we have an e to the 2 pi I. So if we put this in, then suitably normalized, it's not going to matter. Like we have like e e to the I integral this is equal to zero for k in integers times some normalizing constant. So I think I'm messing up my normalizations a little bit, but whatever. So this tells us that this is the general story. I extend my gauge.
One,
sorry. I extend my gauge field to a manifold of one dimension higher. In one dimension higher, I have this term of the Lagrangian, which is purely topological. It's insensitive to small variations in my gauge field. And if you tune it correctly, its value is an integer, so it doesn't contribute anything in the path integral except a purely boundary term. So this is actually a very general story. You can write down similar topological terms in, you know, sigma models in various dimensions, and then on the boundary, you pick up something interesting. This is also, so the Weiss-Amino terms are also like this. So next time I will get the normalizations correct, and we'll write down explicitly the 3D Lagrangian we get from the boundary of this expression. So this discussion was mostly to explain why is it essential that the coefficient is quantized. Okay. Any questions?
So just to repeat again, so what we have done here is that like when I glued n and n prime together on the boundary n, here I showed that like the in the four dimensional manifold, the bulk part doesn't do anything.
Yes. Exactly. So like this action, I've written down this action,
Yeah.
and what we that fact tells us that it doesn't matter how I've extended my three manifold to a four manifold. It only depends on the 3D data. Because if I do it in a different way, I'm multiplying the action by 2 pi times an integer that drops out. Yes.
So I guess the reason why I want to quantize this case is to sort of avoid some kind of gauge anomaly which comes from a boundary or something like that.
Let's see. But, I mean, let me say it another way, right? So if I. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. So we can write down the boundary term, it just looks like for an abelian case, it just looks like ADA. Now, if. So your argument is correct. If I was to apply a large gauge transformation, which is far from the, that doesn't land near the identity, then this would not be gauge invariant. But it can be, if I just put some random constant here, theta, this can always be made gauge invariant by viewing it as the boundary of a four-dimensional system with a certain theta angle. But if theta is an integer, that actually goes away.
So if it wasn't an integer, I would have to couple some extra degrees of freedom living on this four dimensional
Exactly. Yeah, it'll be some topological system of one dimension higher. And then, and the key, you'll have that term in it, that f by f times theta term.
So if I want to have a purely consistent 3D theory, I have to take Q to be integer, but if I don't take it to be integer, I need to extend it on.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's some things you can do fine when it was not an integer, but just because it's perfectly fine to study a 3D system at the boundary of a 4D system, I can do perturbation theory and whatever. You'll run into trouble when you try to define the partition function. You can do the OPEs, you can make it singularities of operators, because that's well defined on the boundary. But something more global, like the partition function, depends on the whole manifold. So it will depend on which four manifold I've used to fill it in. So it won't be invariant under the symmetries of the system.